This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is television journalist Linda Ellerbe. As the co-anchor of Weekend, the Saturday night feature magazine, and NBC Overnight, the Late Late News Hour, Ellerbe managed to break a lot of TV's rules and win the highest praise for it from TV critics and viewers. The Columbia University DuPont Broadcasting Award cited Overnight as possibly the best written and most intelligent news program ever. The word intelligent gets to one of the rules Ellerbe broke. She was frequently advised to cover stories as if viewers had never heard of Lebanon or whatever country the story was about. But Ellerbe says she wouldn't condescend to her viewers. A TV critic described Ellerbe as one of the least sexy anchors on TV, which gets to another rule she broke. She made no attempt to look like a beauty queen. She also didn't put on the corporate dress for success look. She dressed casually. The anchor desk hid the jeans she frequently wore. She stuck with big glasses instead of contact lenses and had a hairdo that was usually slightly mussed. All of the NBC series that she anchored, Weekend, Overnight, and Summer Sunday, were canceled. She parted company with the network after 11 years when NBC offered her a contract that called for a 40% pay cut. She moved to ABC to anchor the new show, Our World. Ellerbe reflects on the state of television news in her bestseller And So It Goes, Adventures in Television, which she's adapting into a screenplay. Even before the publication of her book, Ellerbe was known for the colorful and witty copy she wrote for her broadcasts. Some anchors use scriptwriters, but Ellerbe always insisted on writing her own copy.
I have never understood why, you know, you see stories in the paper where they're paying ex-anchorman or anchorwoman $400 million a year, and then they're allowing what that person says to be written by some 24-year-old in an entry-level job. And I don't understand why anchors allow that to happen. I can't imagine not writing what I say. I'm not an actress. I can't read words. I can't read a script that I didn't write.
The style that you've developed for your journalistic copy on television is more personal, more ironic than the standard copy. What kind of balance do you like to keep between just presenting the facts and injecting more flavor in it?
Well, you have to keep a careful balance. You do. But the audience is intelligent enough to separate fact from thought without you having to put a large flashing neon graphic in front of you saying, commentary, here comes commentary. And you know, that's the dreadful trap we've gotten into in television, that if you're thinking, then it's supposed to be commentary.
Can you think of an example of a story that you wrote the copy for that really is for you a perfect example of the balance that you like to keep between adding, you know, personal thoughts to a story and keeping it, objective and everything?
I'm always terrible when you ask for examples, but most White House news conferences strike me that way. If the president comes out and he says, as he did last summer, and he went on national television and he said that South Africa had eliminated segregation as we knew it in this country, and both you and I know that's not so. I think a reporter has an obligation to stand up and say the emperor is wearing no clothes. That's not so. The man is misinformed. And someone is going to write you and say, well, but that's your opinion. I think we have an obligation to question authority. What we ought to be in the business of is raising questions and not simplifying everything into answers, because very often there is more than one answer.
Was there a story that you wrote where you thought, in retrospect, that you'd gone too far?
I'm sure there is. Not one doesn't come to mind at the moment. If you have one in mind, remind me of it.
No, I didn't really.
I mean, I don't know a reporter who hasn't at some time gone too far, but I will tell you there are just as many, or probably a lot more, that I feel that I didn't go far enough.
What would you have liked to say that you didn't? Can you think of something?
I have a problem with very often we've got into this situation of balance to the extent that if someone goes on the air and says, racism is wrong, we're supposed to put someone on the air who says racism is right. And I simply don't believe in that. I mean, there are things that are right and wrong.
One of the things you didn't want to do on Overnight was to banter back and forth.
No.
With your co-anchor.
I hate that.
What do you have against that?
Well, you know, when you watch people on television, on the news, and they're wasting your time talking about their crabgrass with each other. First of all, they're on television. They ought to be talking to the viewer. And secondly, most of that stuff is manufactured, and it's silly. I mean, it's like when they tell each other the news. Well, John, here I have a story about something that happened in the South Bronx today. Really, Mary? Well, the president said today. It's as if, are we to believe that they've not read these scripts before, much less written them? That all of these stories, it's like when they react to the news, you'll see them watch a story on the air and go, oh. You know, when it comes out, there's a little cute expression or a sad expression. Is it the first time they've seen the story? I mean, I used to see, my habit is to watch the stories before I write the lead in. So that anytime you're doing that little acting the news, it is just that. And a fool would pick that up. No, we never talked to each other on the air. And that was funny. I never said my name on the air. And the whole time overnight was on the air. And what was curious was that newspaper reporters would write about the wonderful chemistry that Lloyd and I had with each other, or that Bill and I had with each other. And how extraordinary a thing, because we were not talking to each other. And what they really meant was chemistry, if you want to use that word, with the audience. And they were mistaking it for something else.
Your image on TV has really been different from the image of most women on television, because you're not dressing to be sexy, you're not dressing for success either. Did you have to fight for the ability to do that? Was there a period where, before you had established your journalistic credentials, when you had to give in to the consultants and to the executives who wanted women to look just so?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there was a time that I would wear my hair slicked back or pulled up, and very often my lip gloss would match my shoes. And, I mean, there was a time when I worked on Weekend when no reporter at NBC had ever been able to persuade the network to buy their clothes for them. And a number of them had tried. And the network bought clothes for Lloyd Dobbins and me. In fact, it insisted on buying our clothes. And it insisted on having someone else pick them out. And then it insisted on keeping them at the network because it was afraid that Lloyd and I would show up with wearing various parts of all our new clothes all at once. And they were probably right. They were very nice clothes. You could do anything in them except work. But the major fights all along were not the clothes. The major fights were the words. One of the first stories I ever covered in Washington for NBC News was the ceremony to hang the official portrait in the Great Hall of Justice of Richard Kleindienst, the only Attorney General of the United States ever indicted on felony charges. And the lead to my story was it was a ceremony of pomp in unusual circumstances. Richard Kleindienst, comma, blah, blah, blah. And the man who was producing for Nightly News looked at it and struck the first line. So it began, Richard Kleindienst, comma, Attorney General, former Attorney General. And it was, and I knew at the time it was just because I was new and I was not trusted. Years later, that same man produced Overnight. And one night there was a story, and I forget what it was, but the lead applied, and I sat down and I typed, it was a ceremony of pomp in unusual circumstances. And I went on with the story, and I handed him my copy, and he looked at it, and he said, good lead, and passed it on. And then I told him.
What did he say?
He laughed. He even recognizes that it is a problem at the network. You get there, and I mean, I was hired years ago at NBC News because, they said, we're tired of gray jello and we want some interesting writing. And the minute I got there, I had to spend a very long time proving that I could write just as dull as anybody else before I was allowed to write anything else. And what happens at networks in that situation more often than not is that the correspondent will begin a dreadful self-censorship. And they will start themselves changing their words into what they know will get by the committee system, when they ought to fight it every single day.
Was there a breakthrough moment for you where you felt like, okay, now I've established myself in my own style and I can continue doing that?
Well, I think probably, no, there was no one breakthrough. Although after I went to work on Weekend, it was pretty much accepted. I suppose, I mean, those sort of things, it's very funny. People who run network news divisions, and this is not just NBC, and it's probably not just network news divisions, are as influenced by what is written about them as they are by their own hearts and minds. And it was probably not until the press began to write about me as being different, as having a style, and as it not being a bad thing, that they were able to say, oh, well, she's weird and she's strange, but maybe it's not so bad.
And that helped you dress the way you wanted to also?
Yeah, well, the dress, by that time, I had just given up the pretense of the, you know, I'd thrown out the lip gloss. The last time I put on lip gloss was, and this is too horrible to say, when I had the picture made for the cover of that book. I had just given up on that because, I mean, you know, they say, oh, well, you want to play with the big boys? Fine, you can go to Washington, you can cover the Congress, and you too can chase a senator down the halls, but you must do it wearing high heels and a little tight skirt.
I've always wondered how women
I
could
fall
wear
over.
High
I'm
heels
clumsy.
And chase after
Nonsense.
Somebody.
Listen. Connie Chung and I once had a conversation about our different ways of covering political conventions, which are, in fact, physically the same way. Connie Chung wears pointy-toed high heel shoes to get through a crowd. They're very effective. My problem is I trip over them. I wear pointy-toed cowboy boots to get through a crowd. It is the same method, just turned inside out.
Well, when you were covering the House, you said that there wasn't a dress code for women because they hadn't thought
That's
of women
right.
being there.
That's right. I wore blue jeans every day, and many of the men would get mad at me because they had to wear coats and ties. And as you say, it was just because there was no dress code for women, because when they wrote dress codes, it never, ever occurred to them that a woman would be covering the Congress.
So what about on TV, though?
Just one other thing about the way I look on television that I think is important. I may not look like all the women you see on television, but I look like an awful lot of the audience.
You have a word for women who...
Oh, it's not just women.
Not just women. No. For women and men who look and act a certain way on television, you call it Twinkie. Describe what that is.
Well, it almost doesn't need description, and I didn't invent the word. I mean, I've heard the word around in the business. I just wrote it down. You know, but a Twinkie is someone who acts the news or models the news or someone you're not certain has read the news, much less written it. You know, a Twinkie, the line I've used before is a Twinkie who's someone who may well have blow-dried their brains right along with their hair.
Do you think that television has to be that way with the Twinkies and with the emphasis on image?
No, I don't. Absolutely not. I mean, that is part and parcel of the major flaw of television news, which is that most of us who do it think we are so much smarter than people who watch it, simply because we're doing it and they're watching it. I mean, that's the Plummer and Albuquerque theory.
My guest is Linda Ellerbe, and she's written a new book titled And So It Goes, Adventures in Television. When you were at Overnight, I think two of the producers were women, and the show was consequently known
inside. Well, the
executive
producer was a woman. The senior producer was a woman. I was general editor, and most of the staff were women.
And so the show was nicknamed Leave It to Beaver?
The men in the building called Overnight, the first network news program run by women, Leave It to Beaver.
Was there resentment that there were all these women running the show?
You know, I think probably among the men who didn't work on it, there was. But for the people who worked on the show, just before Overnight went off the air, NBC had commissioned a study to find out why Overnight, which had the worst hours in the building, also had the lowest absentee rate of any show at the network. And I don't know what they would have found out because the show was canceled during the study. But my guess is what they would have found out, what was the reason was very simple. Women, having not been exposed or had a chance at direct power, didn't really know the rules of the bad rules of the misuse of power, and they tended to treat employees as more than just the carcass you haul to work. They treated them as whole human beings. I will never forget a meeting where we were having a production meeting, and a woman walked in, and she had tears in her eyes. I don't remember exactly what it was. I think the man she was living with had left her. And someone hugged her, and someone made her a cup of tea. And then the meeting went on. And I can't imagine that happening in a male-dominated meeting. You know, we are told that, well, you must denigrate your personal life. You must lower it, and you must, you know, put your work first, or no one will take you seriously here at the corporation. And that leads to all kinds of stress.
Because there are so few slots for women, do you find that women are competitive or supportive of one another once you get into the network?
I mean, my age women, the women who are my age, you know, in their early 40s, late 30s, seem to me to be very supportive of each other. But we also remember the women's movement. I worry about a lot of the young women coming into the business. I hate the word yuppie, but it applies. every time I see a woman who's stitched herself into a female version of a business suit, who is also starting to wear around her neck a noose, whether it's a tied in a bow or a scarf, or they're basically nooses, the same as ties are for men. Why are we doing this? I can't believe that we're going to fall into those same traps. And that's what's frightening. I don't see that as much in the older women, those of us that went through the 60s and the 70s and were part of the first wave.
I've always gotten the impression that women journalists, especially probably television journalists, can't really come out and say that they're feminists, even if they are, because it will seem like a political bias that's going to affect their reporting.
Well, that's one of those things we were talking about earlier when I was saying that, ballots can get way out of hand. I am a feminist, flat out, and I don't feel any reason why I should sit here and say, on the other hand, not being a feminist is a wonderful idea. I don't think it's a wonderful idea. I think it has absolutely everything wrong with it that racism has wrong with it. I mean, to say you're a feminist means you believe in equality of the sexes, period.
In 1978, you threw your television out your window. What prompted that?
Well, that was actually a very simple story. I was trying to have an argument with my husband, a sensible argument, and he was watching Sonny and Cher. You can't have a sensible argument with someone who's watching Sonny and Cher. And he went downstairs to get a Dr. Pepper, I think, as I remember. And I sat there and I looked at the television and I thought, well, you pay my way and I really like you, except you've also caused me a lot of problems. And I don't know what got into me. I went over and I unplugged it and I raised the window and I walked to the window and I threw it as far as I could throw it. And the next day I felt uncomfortable with what I had done, so I went out to the backyard and retrieved it, and it had a big crack right across the screen, but it still worked. And that was the first time I discovered that you can't kill them. Television is forever.
So do you take it out on TV, though, when you're feeling angry at someone?
No, I haven't thrown a TV. I haven't thrown a TV out the window since then, although I did find, I live in Greenwich Village in New York City, and people put things out on the street to be carted off. One day a few years ago, I found an old RCA television with two bullet holes in the screen and no insides. So I immediately took that one inside rather than throwing it. I brought that one in the house and put it in the living room immediately. Every living room has to have a television.
Before your career began in earnest, you spent some time living in Alaska, and you lived collectively there. What was the kind of life you were striving for? What were some of the ideals?
Perfection. There's nothing much, just perfection. This was the late 60s and the early 70s, and we had this idea that if 15 people could live together in peace and harmony, then the whole world could live together in peace and harmony. And the only problem we had was that 15 people couldn't live together in peace and harmony, and we ended up always with, there were some people who would sit around on the sofa at night and say, oh, wow, and far out, and others would be out there on the ice digging holes to haul water up. And as one who continually found herself lying on the ice digging holes, I finally said, wait a minute, this isn't for me. But it was a good time, and it was an interesting time. I learned a number of things. I learned how to kill and dress a deer. I learned that I didn't want to do that. I learned 92 ways how to eat brown rice, and I hope never to swallow brown rice again as long as I live. I also learned a good deal of valuable lessons about living with people and sharing and community in a broader sense than family and yet smaller than a city.
Values now, that you feel you still take with
absolutely.
You?
Absolutely.
Can you tell a story of how you switched from print to broadcast?
I was working for the Associated Press in Dallas in 1972, and they gave us word processors. And I was as low-tech then as I am now. Late one night, after I'd written a story, I think about city council, I wrote a long, chatty letter to a friend. And in the letter, I maligned the Dallas newspapers and the Dallas City Council and Dallas and the Vietnam War and a man I was dating. And I finished off by saying that Renee Peterson, a friend of mine, was leaving the AP, and when she left, I would be the only woman among 16 writers. And if the bureau chief wanted to get rid of his discriminatory guilt, he would hire a half-black Chicano lesbian who could handle the AP style book. And I mean, I wasn't so stupid as to let this get on the wire. No, I was stupid enough to let it get on hold in the computer. The following morning was an Apollo shot, and something keyed the letter, and it went over the AP wire, and I was fired immediately, and rightfully so. They were quite right to fire me. Their mistake was hiring me, which I believe is how they still can look at it over the AP. And I was devastated. I had a 2-year-old, a 3-year-old, and I was then, as I am now, their sole support. And I thought, I've not only have I messed myself up with the AP, I've messed myself up with anybody in the business who would hire me because of this stupid, stupid error. And the reverse happened. I got calls from one of the newspapers I'd maligned and a radio station and UPI and the news director of KHOU in Houston. And he said, have you ever thought about television? And I told him almost never that I had just come from Alaska where they really had no television and I had no television. All I knew about those people was they got in your way on the street and they were forever asking someone how he feels about something. And he said, well, here's what we pay. And it was about twice what I had been making at the AP. And I said, well, I think I could learn television. And just before we got off the phone, he said, oh, by the way, are you 3 feet tall and have warts, big ones, or anything like that? And I said, no, I had them all burned off yesterday. I don't know if I'm the only woman ever hired into television news over the telephone, but I suspect it doesn't happen very often these days.
I'm sure it doesn't. What was your first reaction to yourself when you saw yourself on TV for the first time?
Oh, I was horrified. It's the same reaction that everyone has the first time you hear your voice on a tape recorder, only magnified. There you are at one point, you're also listening to your voice, and there is your picture up there moving and in color. Or in my case, I was as stiff as a board. It was probably practiced for later when Saturday Night Live used to do satire on me about how my face or neck or expression never changed when I did the news. But, you know, it's embarrassing. I mean, to this day, I really don't watch what I do on television.
When the first time you were on the air with David Brinkley was also the first time you met him, basically?
Yes.
That story really surprised me.
We both worked in Washington, and his office was 6 doors down the hall from mine. But he's a shy man, and I did not know this at the time. And I thought he was stuck up, because every time I passed him in the hall, I didn't introduce myself because he looked as if he already knew enough people. And then I was asked to anchor this program, Campaign and the Candidates, with him. I thought, well, now we'll meet, because when we write the show together, we'll have to meet. And we didn't, because he wrote the show in his office with the door shut, so that we did not meet until just a few minutes before air, when we got on the set. And we didn't really meet then because we were both embarrassed to admit we hadn't met. So we just sat down, and we were just before going on air, and I turned around to him and I said, David, Mr. Brinkley, sir, I know you've done this forever, but I'm brand new at it, and I'm very scared. I'm frightened. And he looked at me as if he just noticed I were there, and he said, I don't know why you'd be frightened. All they can do is fire you. Good evening. And we were on the air. And I got it through the show, and about 3 weeks later, when no one had fired me, I realized just how right he was. And it's something I've held on to all these years. He's right. All they can do is fire me. They can't eat me. They can't put me in reporter jail. They can't take away whatever that is that's me. All they can do is fire me.
To some people, though, that's a lot because you get
so involved with your work.
It
is a lot. As someone who's raising 2 kids, it is a lot. But it's not everything. It's really not. And once you understand that and know that, then it gives you a freedom to do things the way you think they ought to be done and not the way you think will please someone.
Have you figured out in your career so far how much to
give to you? I figured out very little in my career so far.
How much to give to your work and how much to keep for yourself?
No, I mean, you always debate that. You're always going to have that. And as I say, especially where children are concerned, you can't, you know, you always hear this, well, I just love it when magazines call me and say, well, we want to do stories about women who have it all, and how do you juggle home and career? And I say, are you crazy? You don't juggle it. You don't balance it. When you are missing the school play because you're at work, you miss the school play. Or when you're at the school play, you missed work. And you're constantly going back and forth on that sort of thing. And you're always going to feel guilty about that. You're never going to come into a resolution about it. And you're going to hope that both your children and your job, the people at your job, will understand and have some forgiveness, and most of all that you will.
Your book jacket says that you live with your two children and a house full of other people. Who else do you live with?
Well, there are... When my editor wrote that, and I said, just don't write anything about my personal life on that jacket. Just write about my work. And he phoned back and he said, I had to write something. And so he wrote that line, and I started laughing. And I said, well, it raises more questions than it answers, but it describes it better than anything I've heard. The simple fact is that when I was coming along and I had little or nothing, there were people who were very good to me. And I have a big place, and I have extra bedrooms. And it has given me great... It makes me feel good to be able to give something back. And so usually those bedrooms are filled with students or young actors or actresses. Don't apply. It's not it's not like that. I mean, they're friends of friends or are relatives of relatives. And they're there. And that's what it is. It's, you know, they pass through.
You plan on staying in television?
I don't know. For the time being, yeah. But I've always felt, speaking of passing through, I've always felt that I was passing through this. And I'm not sure what I'm passing through it to. But I certainly don't see myself doing this 10 years from now, probably not 5 years from now.
Why not?
There are other things I want to do. And one of the things that I want to do is to have a lot of choices. I have the obligations you assume when you're raising children. You assume willingly the financial obligations. My children are at an age where I can see the end of that. And when that happens, I don't need as much money. And frankly, I intend to take some chances. I want to study animation. I have always wanted to study animation. I want to try my hand at directing. There are other things that I want to study and other chances I want to take. And I don't think television is in there. At least not being in front of a camera.
Somewhere down the road.
Yeah.
You'll give that up.
Yeah. Okay. It'll be the easiest thing to give up.
That was TV journalist Linda Ellerbe. Her book, And So It Goes, Adventures in Television, is published by Putnam. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The engineer was Jay Goldman. Fresh Air is edited by associate producer Amy Sallet. Danny Miller and I are the producers of the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
This edition of Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order a cassette of this interview, or for a listing of other programs available on cassette, call toll-free 800-253-0808. In Alaska and Wisconsin, call 608-263-4802. That number again for a cassette of Fresh Air is 800-253-0808. National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible in part with funds provided by Philadelphia-based Cigna Corporation, a provider of insurance and related financial services to businesses and individuals worldwide. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.